Well, good morning, everybody. I'm so glad, quite frankly, shocked that some of you came back. I hope you're having a good time out here at Malibu. And if you weren't here yesterday, we're talking about some of the content and related content of the book I have coming out in September. It's Unarmed Empire. I was not thoughtful enough to have a sign-up sheet for everyone to put their email addresses on. But if you wanted to know about when the book would be released, because it's really important, and those in the publishing industry will know this, around the first week that a book is released, the first week it's released is a kind of a big deal. So if you want to be a part of that, you can email me at sean@thepalmerperspective.com and just put in the subject line or the message, like book, and I will add you to the mailing list. So I'll have your email address then. Yeah?
The super important question,
it will be available on, but by the book, because, I mean, there's a royalty disparity between.
I'm all about hard copies.
Okay, well, you know. This is what I can tell you about. It will be released in paperback, we know. It will be released in Kindle. And I know the publisher has secured the ISBN numbers for an actual hardback. So if you're one of those people who just really loves hardback books, too, I think that might be available. But Kindle, and we're going to try and put it on sale on Kindle the first week. So, but I think more than that, because it's really important, because we're talking about something that people don't talk about very much, which is the role of the church in life. And so one of the things that's really important, when we lived here in California, I lived just outside of San Francisco, about equidistant between San Francisco and San Jose. I was part of what was called the Peninsula Clergy Network, and it technically included every clergy member in that area. So regardless if you were Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Baha'i, whatever, and one year I was chairman of the board for that. And our whole purpose was to help, especially in a place like San Francisco, help communities see that you really can't have any sort of community of flourishing without churches, synagogues, temples, that they play a vital role in community formation. And me, as someone who believes in the uniqueness of Jesus, thinks that churches are actually important, not just as institutions, not just for a place to have VBS to take your kids or a place where you can go and worship and have some friends, not just to get away from people that you don't like at work and who coach your kids' baseball and soccer teams, but actually function in a way that serves society and serves the world. So a couple years ago, I wrote an article for FoxNews.com. The central argument of that article was that the greatest movements for justice and the advancement of people, particularly here in America, the greatest movements have been religious movements, have been fed by religious people, and particularly here in America, by Christian people. So you don't have the civil rights movement in America without the church. You don't have the abolitionist movement without the church. You don't have the women's rights movements without the church. There are actually, just depending on where you want to trace the sources, you can do this on your own. And I know many people, if not most people in this room, would disagree with it. But you actually don't have the pro-life movement without elements of the church. So the greatest movements that we see and experience in America find their root in the church, which is both good and a problem. So we're coming back this last Thanksgiving. My mother lives in Atlanta, and I hate road trips, but I have two kids and a short paycheck, so we can't fly everywhere. So we went to Atlanta to visit my mom for Thanksgiving. We're driving back, and we're talking with our girls about what they want to do for Christmas. And so we have some practices, some spiritual practices around Christmas. And both girls, as we're sitting somewhere driving through Alabama on they really need a tax increase in Alabama because the roads are awful.
We just got one for you.
It's like, I don't care what you think about small governments. These roads stink. And I asked we asked the girls, so what do you want to do for Christmas? And we've always had a policy in our house that each of them, we celebrate the coming of Jesus into the world at Christmas. You only get one present from mom and dad, which is very easy because they're the only grandchildren on either side. My wife is an only child, and my brother and sister-in-law have no children. So they're going to be five come Christmas. And they're both sitting in the back seat reading books, and almost simultaneously come to the same conclusion, which is, we don't need anything and we don't want anything. You don't have to give us anything. My girls are 13 and 10, and I'm thinking, like, you are so few parenting victories, right? They're like, oh, great. And we started talking about what we wanted to do. And so we really believe that Jesus coming into the world, that that's not good news if it's not good news for everybody. And so what we did this last Christmas is there was a family at our congregation whose parents were being evicted. They just couldn't afford their rent. And so we partnered with some people to take care of their rent. There are some Syrian refugees who were in Abilene that some of our friends were working with, and they needed some funds and some help, and so we decided to do that. We decided as a congregation that we would fund presents, we would buy presents and spend time in our community with children whose fathers were incarcerated. And that's what our Christmas was. We have single moms at our congregation, because we have so many first-generation Christians who show up at the Vine after they've made their worst mistake, right? And so we decided we're just going to gift our Christmas to them, because we really believe that the good news should be good news to everybody. And if it's only good news for us, then it's not really good news. But what I also recognize that same November is for the Christian community, what many of us think of as good news, what many of us think of as flourishing, is not good news to the other half of us. That there are some broad places where we agree, but there are many places where there shouldn't even be an argument, really, that we do disagree. So there is a Christian argument on every street corner where there's a homeless person asking for money. And there's a Christian argument that says you should give them whatever spare cash or change you have, and there are Christians who would argue that you shouldn't. And both of those Christians believe that their act or lack of acting is what produces human flourishing. And so when we think about the good news and the good life, what we're really talking about are what acts, actions, and attitudes we believe produce human flourishing. How do people function best? So some people would say, well, the Bible says if a man won't work, he shouldn't eat. So if you're not working, then that's antithetical to human flourishing. So I'm not going to help you so that you will be incentivized to work, because that will produce flourishing. Someone on the other side will say, there are a lot of reasons that you can't work. I remember having a conversation in high school with a girl who really just thought homeless people ought to go to work. And we were sitting outside, we were sitting on a school bus, and there was a homeless guy, and there was a McDonald's across the street with a help wanted sign. She was like, see, he can go over there and get a job at McDonald's if he wants to eat. And I said, well, let's think about what you have to get a job at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. How about a phone number? How about money? You know at McDonald's you have to pay for your uniform. Mm-hmm. How about an address? You wouldn't hire someone at your business who didn't have a phone number and an address, who maybe didn't know what their social security number was. My grandfather died when I was in my mid to late 20s. My grandmother remarried, a really great guy. And I remember him talking about having served in Vietnam and some other things. And we were talking about homelessness, and he said, you know, Sean, realize that homelessness is really more about mental illness than anything. And the more I thought about that, the more that's borne out to be true. But what I want us to see is that we all have our ideas about what creates human flourishing. And the way that we act and worship and the way that we view politics and our country all have their roots in this idea of what we really believe creates human flourishing. And we are all right and all wrong. So one of my heroes is this man right here. His name is Medgar Evers. Medgar Evers was a civil rights leader in Jackson, Mississippi in the 1950s, 1960s, early 1960s. He was one of the leading voices of the civil rights movement in Jackson. I was born in Jackson, Mississippi. On June 12, 1963, Medgar Evers was returning home from a meeting of the local NAACP. It was actually an emergency meeting because earlier that night, John Kennedy had given a national address about race and the nation, and they called a meeting of the NAACP. And as Medgar Evers was getting out of his car, he walked around to the trunk to unload a box of t-shirts. And emblazoned across every t-shirt in the box were the words, "Jim Crow must go." And as he was unloading the box from his car, he was shot with a bullet from an M1917 Enfield rifle from across the street. And he was shot by a man named Byron De La Beckwith. Evers' wife heard the shot. It was late at night. She got up, rushed out. She found him, rushed him to the hospital. When he got to the local hospital, he was still alive, but he wasn't admitted because he was black and they only served white patients. It was only after they realized who he was, that he was this figure in the city, that they decided that they would treat him. But by then it was too late. 45 minutes after he was shot, Medgar Evers died in Jackson, Mississippi. My father was Medgar Evers' paperboy. And every day after school, he would get off the school bus and go to the newspaper office, gather up his newspapers, and walk the neighborhood where Medgar Evers and his family lived, throwing his newspapers. And when I talked with him about it, he said, you know, it was almost as if nothing at all happened. I threw my newspapers there one day. I came back the next day and threw it again, and no one knew. There was no police tape, no investigation going on. If we weren't talking about it in the community, in the black community, it's almost like no one would have known it was happening. We live in this world where people, and oftentimes us, where we don't know the difference between the differences that make a difference and the differences that make a difference. And we end up fighting most of the time about differences that don't make a difference. And we put a lot of weight, place a lot of burden on our differences, about what creates the best life for us, what creates the best life for other people, what creates the best for human flourishing. And so we find a church, as we talked about yesterday, now that's not really committed anymore to building community. We're committed to having power. And our reasoning has been that if we have enough power, then we can just force what we think is the best way to human flourishing on everybody else. So most people in this room don't think that that gay relationships are the best way toward human flourishing. I accept that in any church that you go to, basically in America. We can have a conversation about that, but for the most part, the percentage of people in the church is going to be heavily weighed one way than the other. So instead of creating community around those sorts of issues and offering community to people, we just opt for power and we'll just tell those people not to do that. Right? And what's lost in this is that we create a church that is at odds constantly with our culture, not for good reasons, not for gospel reasons, but just because we want one thing and they want something else, and we're just going to try to push our way through. So I had this experience this last year after the presidential election. I was out of town on Tuesday of the election. I got back in on Wednesday afternoon after the Tuesday night. and we have a gathering at our church on Wednesday night, like a lot of people do, but it includes a meal. And one of the things that's happened at the Vine over my time there has been there's a shift in the center of gravity from baby boomers to millennials. And when we first got there, we thought we had this great idea. We're going to create a worship structure and a feel that's going to be, and I'm not saying this is the right thing to do, but it's just what we did at the time. We said, we're going to gear this thing for a 35-year-old guy. And we figured if we get a 35-year-old guy, he's rising in his career, we'll get him, we'll get the money, we'll get the wife, we'll get the kids, like that. If you're going to create an avatar or somebody, like that's the one to get. So we planned this worship service, these outreach type things to get that guy, and what we got was 50-year-old women. 50-year-old women loved it. We were just all over the place, but that shifted. And now we have been, for the last 2 years, attracting people who are, in my view, very young. That when they tell me how young they are, I think, well, that's not really even possible. Like, how are you 23? Like, how is that possible? But what's also true of those groups is they have very different views of the world. And so I walk in on Wednesday night, and the tension in the room is palpable. Because I have got a good set of people on this side who are so happy they are having trouble containing themselves. And I've got this side of the room who is quite frankly in despair. Deep despair. Numb. Mm-hmm. So what do you do when those are the churches that we walk into? And so I started thinking about that, because there's not unanimity about all of these things, and there's certainly not unanimity about how we go about maneuvering around certain topics, even if we agree on them. What's our posture? What's our language? And then I came across this really great book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind. And what Jonathan's doing in The Righteous Mind is he's looking at moral reasoning and why America is divided, why good people are divided over politics and religion. The book is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided Over Politics and Religion. And they did all of these surveys and all these studies over the course of the year. You can go to his website and you can take the survey yourself. And he's a sociologist and looked at just moral development, moral formation over many cultures, over a long period of time, to see why people think what they think, why we think what we think about what we think. And so this is what Haidt discovered, that there is a moral matrix, that there are five channels that everyone uses to make moral decisions. And those channels are harm, fairness, authority, in-group, and purity. And so all of those five channels, when you make decisions, you're using one or more of those channels to make that decision. The way you view the world is formed by one or more of those channels. And what they've learned through their research and study is that if you are a liberal person, whether it's politically, whether it's economically, whether it's in terms of religion, what's really high for you, what's very important for you, are harm and fairness. Like, you look at everything through the lens of harm and fairness, and it's astronomically high. And you have a fairly low regard, if you're a liberal, for authority, in-group, and purity. It's not that you don't care about those things. You just care about those things a lot less than you care about harm and fairness. But if you are conservative, as we move across the chart, look how steep authority, in-group, and purity become. And they take all of these channels, and they are about the same. And so what we've learned is that if you're a conservative person, here's the good news. You use all five channels of moral reasoning. All five. But you don't use any of them as highly as a liberal person cares about harm and fairness. And what that means is, though you're using all five, you're not deeply, deeply, deeply connected to any one of them. Right? But here's the good news if you're a liberal. you care so much about harm and fairness that you make a really good neighbor. So, what does this mean for the church? Well, it means when you're having conversations next Sunday at church and something tense comes up, you'll be able to tell what matters to the person you're talking about. So, when you're watching the news and they're talking about something about Black Lives Matter, and you're just thinking, well, people just need to respect the police. If they just do it, they say, why did he run? Someone says that, conservative. And they're not conservative, that doesn't make them a bad person. That just means they are channeling into authority. Right? My brother comes to my house at the beginning days of the Iraq war, and he goes, how come you don't have an American flag outside of your house? We're raised in the same house, by the way, me and my brother. He's channeling in-group. Why doesn't President Obama wear a lapel pin of the American flag? In-group. Colin Kaepernick doesn't stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, protesting police violence against black people. Where does he get that from? Harm and fairness. He dedicates last week millions of dollars for kids to get an education. Why does he do that? Harm and fairness. You should stand for the flag. People died for that flag. Where do they get that? Authority and in-group. Gay people need to not be gay. Where do they get that?
Purity.
So what's happening is, all of our disagreements are never disagreements about the issue. They are simply the way that we reason morally. And the good news about that is that everyone is using moral reasoning. Because our instinct is to say that those are bad people. House Republicans vote for a bill. They don't care anything about people. Where does somebody, why would somebody say that? Harm and fairness. Vote for me because we will be stronger together. Where do you get that? Harm and fairness. Vote for me, make America great again. Where do you get that? Authority and in-group. This is the way we reason morally. And this is why that people like Jonathan Haidt can look at an election and tell you who's going to win. And this is the reason that he knew that Donald Trump was going to win, because at different periods of time, Donald Trump channeled all five channels of moral reasoning. Now, if you're a liberal, you don't believe that because you think, where does he talk about harm and fairness? They're stealing our jobs. Do you know what Hillary tried to do in the last election? All the police and military on stage at the Democratic National Convention. Do you know why they did that? Trying to channel authority and in-group. And what I think is important is to know that everyone you know is using moral reasoning. That the other side isn't stupid. It's not that they don't care. It's not that they're immoral. They care and use moral reasoning differently than you do. That's why 7 years ago, 8 years ago, during the Tea Party protest, you flick on Fox News, who I have worked for, and they will say, well, after these protests, everybody cleaned up. The place where they had the protest was left clean. What? Why do you care if it's left clean? Well, after those Black Lives Matter people protested, they burned down a CVS. Why does that matter? You're talking about people being shot. You're worried about CVS. It's moral reasoning. Liberals can live with a little chaos if it creates harm and fairness. And conservatives can live with inequality and unfairness if it maintains authority. Just think about that for a while. And if that's not true of every eruption in church politics and world politics that you've ever seen, well, the Bible says it. I don't see anything here for no praise team standing on stage. Why is it always conservatives that give the argument, oh, that's a slippery slope? The loss of authority. Why is it always liberals who say, well, let's just do it and we'll figure out what we're doing as we go? They can live with a little chaos if they think it creates harm and fairness. Now, I say that just to make you the smartest person in your church, and the next meeting you're at, you know how to manipulate everybody. Yeah. But at least you know how we are functioning as a people and as people. So, Hike goes on to say this. He says, the righteous mind unites us into teams, divides us against the other team, and blinds us to truth. Unites us into teams, divides us against the other team, blinds us to truth. So one of the things that we've done every year that I've been at the Vine is that the first Sunday of the NFL season, we have Jersey Sunday. And you just wear the jersey or shirt of your favorite professional sports team, whatever it is. And we talk about the same things, that the idea is that once you buy a jersey, once you buy apparel from a sports team, like, you are committed. Right? And, like, so the refs always call against your team. Right? Like, that's East Coast bias. My friend Tim Spivey has a rant about East Coast bias in college football every fall. And Faith's right there with him. And we just talk about this central idea that once you're on a team, and this is important, once you're on a team, the other team becomes the enemy. So back in the 50s, there was a college football game between the two great powerhouses of Princeton and Dartmouth. And it was particularly brutal. And so sociologists wanted to discover why this game was particularly brutal. I mean, people got hurt, sent out, this is all for all the pads and all that. And in short, here's what they found out. As they polled people and did research, all of the Princeton players and fans, for the most part, thought that it was Dartmouth's fault. And all of the Dartmouth fans and players thought it was Princeton's fault. Right. Once you've picked a team, the other team becomes the enemy. And you can just go through your own life, your own church, your own local politics, whatever it is, and you will see that to be true. And so Haidt says, morality binds and blinds. It binds us into ideological teams that fight each other as though the fate of the world depended on our side winning each battle. It blinds us to the fact that each team is composed of good people who have something important to say. So if you're a church that is really consumed with power and not community, you're not worried about what the other side has to say. You're just worried about the other side complying. That they bend to whatever you think is the best picture of human flourishing. And so Jesus comes along, and he meets this man that the Bible refers to as the rich young ruler. And they have an astonishing conversation. When he, Jesus, traveled on, a young man came and knelt in the dust of the road in front of Jesus. Good teacher, he says, what must I do to gain life in the world to come? Which I think is a good question, one that we'd all be wise to ask. Jesus says, you are calling me good? Don't you know that God and God alone is good? Anyway, why ask me that question? You know the commandments of Moses. Do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not slander, do not defraud, and honor your father and mother. Yes, teacher, I have done all these since I was a child. Then Jesus, looking at the young man, saw that he was sincere and responded out of his love for him.
son, there is still one thing you have not done. Go now, sell everything you have and give the proceeds to the poor so that you will have treasure in heaven. After that, come follow me. The young man went away sick at heart at these words because he was very wealthy. And Jesus looked around to see if his disciples were understanding his teaching. Now, that's a crazy teaching. And the reason I know it's crazy is because there's almost no one that I know that has done that, who has sold all of their things and given it to. I know some people who have, but who sold everything and gave it to the poor. And it's one that's hard to unpack because you don't see the disciples later going around saying, well, we're starting these churches and we just can't convince these people to sell all their stuff to the poor. So obviously they didn't think this teaching was for everybody, or they just missed it and they rejected it. But you also don't see Jesus, that Jesus telling people to do things and it only being for them. So there must be something more at play here. And there are a couple of things that I want to suggest about how this story can help the church. One is that churches have to learn to speak from love. And what we tend to want to do is speak from our version of love. So we come up with our idea of what human flourishing is, and then we say whatever we want to say, and then convince ourselves that was the loving thing to say. So it's like finding someone in the gym and calling them fat, right? Like, yeah, they know that. That's where they're in the gym. And like you saying that isn't a loving thing. It may be true, but it's not helpful, right? So people in churches have to learn to speak from a place of love. The story says that Jesus looked at this man and loved him. He told him something hard, but it came from a place of love. And I think it would be really wise, before we said anything, to really check our motives. So one of the subchapters in the Unarmed Empire covers the idea of what I call the point system. And it began sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I think it's important. Like, how about before you said anything publicly or had any opinion about LGBT people, that you had to earn enough points? Mm-hmm. So you had to have, you get 10 points for having a really close gay friend. You get like 20 points for having a gay relative. You get like 5 points for having a gay coworker that you go out to lunch with once a week. And like once you've gotten enough points, like once you've added up enough points, like then you could say something. Because then you'd know that you were speaking from love. Like you wouldn't be speaking to or about a caricature. But I think also with that is this idea of playing for others. So here's what's crazy about this story. Jesus tells this man to go and sell all of his possessions to the poor. And we don't believe that that was handed down to us for every Christian forever to sell all of their possessions to the poor. If we did, more of us would do it. Not all of us would do it, but more of us would do it. We just fundamentally don't believe that that's what this teaching is about. But for this guy who comes to Jesus and who is rich, what happens if you sell all of your possessions to the poor?
You become poor among the poor.
You get to be poor. Like you get to live their life. And what I think Jesus is fundamentally trying to get us to understand is that if you want to follow me, like you can follow the law and go on your way, but if you want to truly follow me, you got to learn to play for the other side. Like you've got to become the other side. To know where they're coming from, what they want at a deep level. That they aren't just caricatures or people or even just or friends, but it's like you have gotten under the skin of other people. So in September at Abilene Christian, Jonathan and I are teaching a class together. And so here's the genesis of that class. There's a book that I loved called Stand Your Ground, Black Bodies and the Justice of God. Right, and I think every person needs to read Stand Your Ground, Black Bodies and the Justice of God. And then Jonathan said, well, I will read it if you will read Hillbilly Elegy. Because Jonathan is a hillbilly. And I'm a black guy from Atlanta. And so I get Stand Your Ground. I don't get Hillbilly Elegy.
he gets hillbilly elegy. Like, the people in Stand Your Ground, those are my people. People in Hillbilly Elegy are Jonathan's people. You've got to learn to play for the other side. And I had this experience very clearly 4 or 5 Thanksgivings ago. My wife is white, and oddly enough, so are most of her family. And we were in Houston for Thanksgiving with her family. And her cousin Andy is a Houston police officer. And this was at the time of Trayvon Martin and Fred Gray and on and on and on. And if you think you've gotten tired of hearing those names, there are about 100 other names that you don't hear. And so I grew up in Mississippi and Atlanta, and I have a certain experience with police officers. And while most of it's good, the bad experiences are really bad. Yeah. And so her cousin shows up, Andy, and he's going to work right after we eat. And so he arrives, and he's got his uniform on, bulletproof vest. He's got his belt and holster on. Walks through the house, and I think that's when he realized, when there are, you know, 1,000 children in the house, I probably ought to go put this gun away. So he goes to the car, comes back, and he's not armed anymore, because an armed Thanksgiving really isn't as much fun as you think it might be. I know for some of you that's pretty standard. Jonathan's family, mostly. And so we eat. And, he looks so uncomfortable trying to eat this big meal with this bulletproof vest on. I've known Andy since he was 14 or 15. He's a good kid, Mormon, and everything that you think of when you think of kind of your good Mormon neighbors. And we're over, and he's got to go to work. And so he gets up, and he does what every husband and father does when they leave for work. And has for centuries. He hugs his 3 little kids. And at the door, he stops and hugs his wife, Heather, and gives her a kiss. And leaves. And I thought in that moment, okay, the numbers of police officers who are shot and killed in the line of duty is really very small. And in fact, in the last few years, has been declining steeply. But when he goes to work, it's really not like when I go to work. And like, we can disagree about any number of things, but there is a fundamental difference in the way that he sees the world and the way that I see the world. And I don't owe it to him, but I owe it to the gospel, to following Jesus, to try to understand the world that he lives in. When Jesus says, sell your possessions, give it away to the poor, and come follow me, what Jesus is teaching us is that if you want to be a follower of Jesus, a core commitment is getting beyond yourself and inside the lived experience of other people whom Jesus loves as much as he loves you. And I think that would transform your church and my church and the world if instead of having opinions about everything and words about everything and thoughts about everything, that we would sit down with the people who are most unlike us and say, I want to be able to see and understand the world that you see and understand. That you're not stupid. You are using moral reasoning. You are not a bad person. And I'm such a good person, I'm going to follow Jesus into this. And I think if you did that, that the church would become a place that could be a community for all. So Jonathan has to take his computer, which I'm using, because he's got a class here in a little bit. But I can, let's talk for 2 or 3 minutes.
Is there one more point you have to say?
No, just, I don't do 3s.
In church twice, there's got to be 3. Yeah.
Make one up. I'll do 2 or I'll
if
do
I'm
4.
Preach it, there's got
to
be 3.
So, you have to come up with your own, Yeah, make them all start with F or P or something like that. Okay. Yeah, Jeremy.
You know, Sean, here's where I have difficulty, because I see what Jonathan Haidt's doing, and I agree. Like, I can see it intellectually, and I guess I'm kind of this weird person who my values tend to be, like, progressive as all get out, but my basic temperament tends to be more conservative, which is a weird mix. So I guess I'm a flaming moderate. But
the passionate middle.
Right. But the difficult thing for me is this, and this is why I have such a hard time with some of my fellow Christians who, like, you know, they'll say, well, gee, you know, you're a godless Marxist. And I'm like, yeah, but you like Ayn Rand. Like,
yeah.
I don't get that. Yeah. And
the Ayn Rand thing is funny to me. Did you actually read it, or just the clip notes?
Right. But the other thing, here's the problem. To me, a fundamental understanding of what's going on in the biblical story and what's going on in the gospel, it's not that purity and authority and in-group don't matter to Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of liberal and progressive Christians are just like, well, those things don't matter. But he does redefine them so that purity and in-group, so he broadens the in-group.
Yeah.
He redefines purity from, you know, something kind of external to who you are on the inside, like what, you know, and your actions flowing from that toward other people. So it's very practical. And authority is rooted in the kingdom of heaven, you know, which is a very different concept. I don't understand. I understand Christians being conservative because that's your temperament. Mm-hmm. I don't understand, and I have a very difficult time, and I hate this, you know, but for being kind of forgiving and gracious here, because it's like, and maybe I'm just, like, really wrong, and I can admit that, but I'm like, are you reading the same gospel I am? Because I understand that even with Jesus, authority, in-group, purity, those are important, but through Jesus and through Paul, those things should be radically redefined for the Christian, and I don't understand. I try to communicate that in my preaching and teaching, but I guess where's that disconnect? I feel like there's a disconnect there to where we've almost in the church sort of rebabbled. If Acts is a debabbling, I'm using babble as a verb, right? We've sort of rebabbled so that now we're just, okay, we're this team in the culture wars.
Yeah.
And that's problematic. And I guess I'm looking for an answer to a question I'm having a difficult time articulating.
Yeah, so you're not the only one. There are a couple of reasons. So fundamentally, at the heart of the book, it's a reading of Paul through the book of Romans and what Paul considers to be the church. And I think fundamentally what we discover is that there is a broadening of what is called family.
Right.
And that's here's the fundamental Christian story. That no one says. So the second chapter of the book is the new story you already knew. That the God of the Jews has been vindicated as the real, true, and living God through the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, and now Gentiles as well as Jews have access to eternal life with that God. That is the gospel. If you don't believe me, it's 1 Corinthians 15. God of the Jews has been vindicated through the resurrection of Jesus, who is now not only the God of the Jews, but the God of all people. And so Romans 8 ends with this idea of that Jesus is the firstborn of a very large family.
Right.
And so that all people are called into that family. We've totally missed that because we spent most of our time in the book of Romans talking about how I can feel better about my sins.
Right.
Which is not the central argument of the book, nor about the ministry of Paul. The central argument of Paul is that God has been vindicated through the resurrection of Jesus. And now everyone has access to that God. And that grace is the mechanism by which everyone is welcomed into that family. But grace is the point. Welcoming into the family is the point. And this is everywhere in every letter of Paul.
It is.
So we talk a lot about grace, but it's really about family. Now, the flip side of that is you have a family, I have a family. I'm sure if your family were here and we spend a lot of time together, we would get to know and love one another and care about one another. You're not coming with us on our family vacation. Because that's for our family.
Right.
Some years. This upcoming year, we'll go with another family. And so one of the things that we have to be really careful and thoughtful about is that there are edges to what we consider family. And so it's not that just everybody's in willy-nilly. But there are some boundaries. And that boundary, for me, it may not be for everyone, for me is a confession of, that Jesus Christ is Lord. That statement about God being vindicated through Jesus is true. So churches have to decide. This is why the New Testament can also say, though we don't care about this anymore, the New Testament can also say, be generous to everybody, but first to the people of God. We're not particularly good at that. And I think the reason that it's first to the people of God, not is because Paul is so in the in-group, but because it's in the church that we learn to do things that we will then go and practice in the world.
Right.
But we have failed to learn those things because we'd much rather pick our churches based on the worship style and the preacher that we like and how close it is and the programs for the kids and the teenagers. And when a church challenges us on our weaknesses, we leave. Mm-hmm. And we've forgotten that the church is supposed to challenge us on our weaknesses. So when you leave church uncomfortable and ticked, you had good service that day. So I think we have to go back and forth and be very discerning and about how all that looks at particular times and what God is calling us into. And the best protection against the next word from God is the last word from God.
Right.
Right. And there's very little anticipation that God's going to call us into something new or do something different. And we're just going to stick with the last one we got. And God had to drag us kicking and screaming into that one anyway.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Because, I mean, I'm preaching Philip in the Ethiopian eunuch on Sunday. And, you know, the initial word from God is no foreigners, no eunuchs in the assembly. You guys. And Isaiah 56, you know, says, okay, well, the situation's different. Come on in, guys. Foreigners, eunuchs, you're welcome. But it takes, what, like 600 years or more for Philip to finally... Yeah. Embody that, and it's really interesting that that's how that works out.
Yeah, I think all through history, people of God has used God as a consultant, right? And like, we'll get back to you on that after we think about it a little bit more. But one more, maybe. No one's busting through the door yet for the next session, but I know I want to free you guys up. Yeah,
let's talk about fear.
Fear.
When I see that lower spectrum, those three things you put there, I experience fear.
Okay.
I live in Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm.
So far right, you can't go any further. Okay?
I bet you can. And that would be fine. That would be fine.
When I look at harm and fairness, I see people through my eyes that are not afraid. When I look at the other spectrum, I see people that are afraid. You're going to get my stuff, you know?
Well, let me tell you, when I see harm and fairness, I see people who are afraid.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't see too many of those, so tell me what it's like.
Because there's not enough black people in Colorado Springs.
That is true.
I mean, the fundamental argument of the civil rights movement, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. says... I can't make a man love me, but I can stop him from lynching me. Harm and fairness is a hedge against physical violence, against workplace discrimination, that are both feared and real. So I tell a story in the book of a group of white teenagers in Jackson, just down the street from where I used to live, who decide one night that they want to go out, and they say, let's go kill us some niggers. Like, that was like 3 years ago. And so when minority populations talk about community policing, their motivation is harm and fairness, but it's also fear. And I want to be able to walk down the street. I want to be able to send my teenage son out to the store. We had this, my wife used to teach in a school district about 20 miles from us. It's got a lot of African-American and Latino kids, and she picked it on purpose. She's at an elementary school now with a high Hispanic population. She picked that on purpose. And every time we would tell white congregants at our church, and they would be like, oh, Colleen, and they'd get these big eyes, like it was dangerous. And I just told one of our elders' wives that she was serving me chili one night on a Wednesday night. I said, that's okay, because Rochelle's just not afraid of black kids. And like she was taken aback, but I got tired of hearing that narrative. Because one of my good friends who's Hispanic was a principal at one of those high schools, and he said, let me show you some numbers one day at lunch. And the white communities were having a whole lot more fights, a whole lot more violence. But it's the perception. Yeah. So it just may depend on where you live and what you see, but I think there's a fair, and it's not really fear. So, I mean, sometimes it's fear. Fear is concern about it being in immediate impending danger. What we're experiencing right now, I think, in the country is anxiety. Yeah. And it's over. One of the best books you can buy is by a guy named John Muir. It's called Overblown. And basically, he looks at the numbers. Like, you've got more of a chance of dying this next year from a television falling on you than being killed by an Islamic terrorist. But when you look at them, you look at the narrative in our culture and the money that we spend, you would think that there's a terrorist going to be waiting outside by the... and so things are driven by fear, and it's overblown, it's anxiety-producing, and it's just... Anyway. But we're out of time. I've got a plane to catch this afternoon, so I'll hang out here for a little bit if someone else has any questions, but I'm not going to be fair to the next guy or you if we keep going. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Good job.